Welcome to Neighbor Science.
Welcome to season two of Neighbor Science.
Yeah, I was gonna say that, god damn it. Today's topic is going to be industrial ecology, something that we both have been reading about for quite a while. Apparently I've read quite a bit more about it. But
oh yeah,
I think we both discovered it probably, what, 2010, something like that?
Yeah, more or less. I think the first time I looked it up was like the end of 2009, and then it was just cursory. And since then I've skimmed a lot more. Like we were talking about earlier, I haven't gone in depth with the topic, and I'm actually hoping that I get to learn quite a bit today. But just so that our listeners know, what we're doing now for the next season is to give you a more coherent experience with the podcast is we're going to be running everything in kind of like a slight leftist framework where we discuss topics that are very pertinent to leftist theory as we understand it, and the development thereof, instead of just, you know, picking stuff that we find fascinating and interesting, we're going to pick stuff that we find fascinating and interesting and has an overall cohesive feel to it.
And we're still going to do episodes where we just pick stuff that's interesting.
Oh yeah, totally.
Because like, these ones, the ones that Peter's talking about, they're going to require, like, you know, a lot more research. And you know, we both work full-time jobs, so we're going to have to do that research in our spare time. So, we're hoping to do like one of those a month.
Yeah.
So today we're starting with industrial ecology, and this is actually something we're not that late on. We discovered it in 2010, but it wasn't really even formalized until 1989. So we were only 20 years late.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Not bad.
Which is better than I can say for a lot of other podcasts out there who are covering topics that are hundreds of years old.
Yeah.
I was going through some podcasts the other day just looking for something interesting to listen to, and I came across, I can't even remember their name, they're that forgettable. And basically, it was this pro-capitalist podcast, and it was just so much drivel, and it, like, literally, it was about the whole episode was like 2 hours of basically just let me see how much of Adam Smith's boots I can lick, and I fell asleep 3 times and had to restart.
Oh, was it Was it the Partially Examined Life?
Yes, that's it.
Yeah. Yeah, everyone was telling me to check that out, and I was like, okay, yeah, a bunch of my leftist friends are telling me it's good, so I'm sure it's pretty good.
God.
And the latest
friends?
Episode is like, Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations. I was like, oh, I am not going to like this.
Yeah.
No. I think I made it like 15 minutes in. I was like, this is bad. Sorry, guys.
Yeah, it's not just that the content of the show is bootlicking boredom. It's also that they didn't even bother to try and make any of it interesting. So I don't know. I just,
well, for me the worst part was they were like, oh, we critically examine, like, the show description was something like, we critically examine topics, or like we take like a skeptical approach or some shit like that, and then they would read something from Smith and they'd just be like, yeah, that sounds pretty good, yeah, I think that's,
yeah,
right.
Yeah, this guy that said,
like,
some
really?
Stuff
you're not
like
gonna challenge
two,
any of it?
200 years ago, and he obviously couldn't have had any idea about how the world really functions in the modern world, but it seems like he really was spot on. Wait, what? Okay, so I suppose my first question, and the question of most people out there, would be, what is industrial ecology?
Right. So just to talk about my source for most of this, I have this book that I've had for a while called The Greening of Industrial Ecosystems. It's pretty old. It's from 1992, I think. And it's by the National Academy of Engineering, which is like a government organization in the United States, made up of engineers from a bunch of different backgrounds, which is actually fitting because industrial ecology is a multidisciplinary study. So a lot of different disciplines do go into it. But the basic idea of industrial ecology is that industry is similar to an ecosystem and should be analyzed as such. And they use that perspective in an effort to improve, one, industrial efficiency, so making more things with less, or making the same amount of stuff with less. Two, ecological beneficence, as in, like, reducing the impact, the harmful impact on the ecosystem, in order to, you know, maintain the ecosystem as well as the benefits to humans that the ecosystem has. Three, civilizational longevity, so ensuring that we don't use up our resource base and then collapse as a civilization because we can't maintain ourselves. And then four, intergenerational fairness, you know, baby boomers taking too much and leaving nothing for millennials and then, as I call them, generation eschaton, but whatever they call the next generation.
Generation what?
Generation eschaton, because they're going to live through the eschaton.
I like it. I'm not even going to argue that one. okay, so I suppose for those that find any of this a little bit over their heads, basically what it comes down to then is industrial ecology is looking at the sustainability of industry. From an ecological perspective, or is supposed to.
Right.
Great. Thanks.
Just to talk a little bit more about intergenerational fairness, because I guess it is something that I don't think I've ever heard it brought up really outside of this book, now that I think about it. You know, it's something that if you're a millennial, you probably understand intuitively. And I mean, I guess I did explain it kind of tersely. But, you know, the baby boomer generation, we make fun of them all the time for saying how easy they had it and how easy that we have it. And all we need to do is, you know, go to school, graduate, and then, like, walk right up to the boss and ask for a job, and then you'll get a job, and then you'll buy a house and retire.
Because that's how it worked for them.
Yeah, I mean, that is, yeah, it's how it worked for them, but that's not how it worked for any generation before them, and it's probably not going to be that way for any generation after them. And, you know, a significant factor in that was them using the advanced technology of the 20th century to just take extraordinary amounts of wealth for themselves with no thought as to whether or not this would be sustainable at all, whether or not they'd be, you know, taking from future generations, and whether or not, you know, it may cause civilizational problems like climate change and ocean acidification and all that good stuff. And, you know, intergenerational fairness is a moral argument, which is, you know, we could say, like, you know, economically they did something bad, but, like, I think moral arguments are pretty powerful and are underutilized, but we should be morally good too, not just technically good.
Mm. Yeah, no, I think as much as I agree with the contrast between millennials and baby boomers, obviously there's a sort of missing generation in between. That there's an actual institute that focuses on this. I think it's called the Institute and Faculty of Actuaries, and they did a
That sounds boring.
Yeah. No, I was doing some research. I've told you before, I haven't told the podcast, but I've told you before, my grandmother used to be a research fellow for a university. And yep. Part of the, I've done some work with and for her in consolidating research in academic editing, so on and so forth. And one of the things I had to look at was intergenerational fairness. That had the context at that point was healthcare and healthcare waste systems.
I guess that's one other context it is brought up is Social Security. That's a big one there.
Yeah, I mean, look, it comes up in topics like retirement and the investment in retirement funds and so on. It does come up in healthcare, but the big one that stood out for me at the time, because of my interest in ecological issues, was climate change. I mean, it's very obvious when we look at the system the way it is now, how the and it's not just the baby boomer generation, it's several generations before them. They didn't really give a shit about the future generations. Everything from the industrialists, I suppose you could even go further back and say the mercantilists, they all looked at how much could be extracted for their own benefit without ever looking at whether or not it's going to be sustainable in the long run.
Right.
And I dare say that millennials are really the first generation that has been forced to, but willingly have taken it upon themselves to start planning for the future, to start taking the next generation into account. And it's still a growing trend. It's not like something that's become prevalent in society. But I think if you were to compare the generations, if there was a means to do so, and you compared them, you would find that the newer generations, the millennials, the... What did you call them?
Generation Eschaton.
Generation Eschaton.
Jenny. Let's just call it Jenny.
Yeah, Jenny. Jenny cares a lot about the future because obviously they are having to deal with the most of it at the moment.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely... There's a self-interest component to it. Mm. So it's not just like we're like a more moral generation and we're so much better than baby boomers. Although we are. baby boomers are terrible. Self-interest is fine. You know, it's fine that we are coming upon a like moral question. I don't know. Based on self-interest. If that causes us to... ask this moral question and respond to it, then that's good.
Agreed. Okay.
All right, so let's move on, I guess.
Yeah. So, as with any field of study, I think industrial ecology has both strengths and weaknesses. Maybe you can talk us through some of the strengths of industrial ecology as a field of study.
Yeah. So the one that that we'll be the biggest fans of, I know you will be, is the systems analysis aspect of it.
Yes,
which is
I love analyzing systems.
Yeah. So basically, you know, when economics analyzes industry, it essentially just ignores it. It treats the monetary portion of the economy as like this perfect reflection of industry. That tells us all that we need to know about it, and you know, there's no other questions we need to ask. So it analyzes industry at the level of the firm, and in this case, when I say firm, I really mean business, because there's a whole different concept of the firm that we could talk about. Maybe we should put that in the master plan, actually. Industrial ecology, on the other hand, analyzes industry as a wider system that has, you know, interconnected parts between these different businesses. You know, an industry isn't just a collection of atomized businesses that are, you know, just swapping things back and forth with no regard to each other than the price of goods and the amount of revenue they're getting. There is actually some amount of coordination that's required outside of that particular process. So there has to be a whole...
Wait, so you mean... that producers within a system are not all rational self-maximizers, but...
Yes, capitalist industry is centrally planned.
It really is.
Yeah. You know, there has to be supply chains formed. You know, if you want to produce a product, you can't just, like, start a business and produce a product all completely by yourself. You know, you have to get supplies. You have to manufacture the product or hire manufacturers to produce the product. You have to transport it, package it, all that stuff. So an industry involves all of that stuff and not just, you know, the collection of those things happening atomistically without any concern to one another.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, there is a lot of coordinating that happens. Sometimes it's deliberate, sometimes it's incidental, sometimes it's coincidental. Mm-hmm. But there's always a lot of planning that goes into any industry that a lot of consumers and general public are completely unaware of.
Right. And so industrial ecology attempts to say, okay, we have this industry that's actually a system. So instead of having each individual business try to meet some kind of climate change target in order to, you know, or emissions target to reduce its pollution. We need to look at the industry as a whole and figure out how we can shape the industry as a whole to reduce pollution far more than we ever could by looking at it as a set of atomized producers that have nothing to do with each other.
Definitely. So essentially we're looking at then changing an entire design process to reflect a sustainable outcome, rather than expecting individual aspects within the design to maximize efficiency, for instance.
Right.
I think a good example of this would be considering the photovoltaic solar panel industry. Instead of just trying to focus on maximizing the energy output of a solar panel, you've also got to look at the silicon mining that goes into producing a solar panel and the supply chains that bring that silicon to the producer, the factories where it gets made, as well as the specific minerals that are incorporated, as well as the distributions, and every single one of those aspects has to conform to an industry standard for sustainability, rather than just expecting one of those elements. Because this is what we see in the news, this is what we see in the media, is, oh my god, new solar panel technology breaks new records with... But no one cares about...
Yeah, multi-junction photovoltaics can achieve 45% efficiency, but, you know, they don't point out the part where it takes huge amounts of energy to produce, and it only works in a lab, and it's extremely expensive, and
yeah,
nobody can really do it with the existing manufacturing.
Yeah, whatever we do today, we are not going to discuss Elon Musk's trucks. Please. And I've been talking to a lot of people about those, and I'm sick of it.
And then, like, another example would be, like, but like the overall thrust of it is, like, they ask more radical questions than, you know, the average person thinking about ecology is going to. Like I said, you know, if you're an economist and basic ass environmentalist, you're going to be like, oh, how can we get each company to reduce its emissions? Whereas industrial ecology can ask questions more like, should we be producing automobiles at all?
Mm.
Like, is that ever going to be sustainable?
Is it? Is this a good idea?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, it seems like anytime we identify a problem with capitalism, of course, usually it's not portrayed as a problem with capitalism. It's portrayed as just a problem that happens to exist in our capitalist system. Mm. And so, like, you know, any time a problem comes up, it's always put into the least radical terms possible.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
Yeah. Sorry. I think is it Amsterdam or Rotterdam? I can never remember which one of the two it is that has the...
Those are the same place.
Say what?
That's the same place.
Rotterdam?
Rotterdam, Amsterdam. Yeah, it's one's just you say with a funny accent.
I know very many Dutch people that will be very offended by that statement. The people of Rotterdam are extremely proud of their artistic cultural heritage.
Well, that sounds nationalistic, so...
Yeah. Okay, so I know that in Holland, industrial ecology played a very big part in creating parts of... I'm sure it's Amsterdam, where parts of the city were zoned as vehicle-free, where you're no longer...
Yeah, that kicks ass.
Yeah, where they basically looked at it and said, it makes no ecological sense to allow vehicles to drive through these areas where they're spewing pollution, number one, and where it's more efficient to ensure that everyone can access everything by walking and cycling. And what's actually happened there since then is a complete turnaround in the culture in those areas. And it all stems from industrial ecologists looking at the full system of the city and the various industries that were affecting not just the pollution levels and so on, but the full ecology of the city, and reaching the conclusion that as a system, it doesn't make sense to allow cars in there. And this is, I think, a prime example of how industrial ecology is able to make sustainable decisions for society.
Yeah. So the next thing that I wrote as a strength is it uses flow-based analysis. So again, instead of treating things as just these atomized pieces that, you know, barely interact with one another, it looks at material and energy flows through industry as a whole. Again, whereas the neoclassical would look at only the money going through the system, and not even really the flow of money, they don't even really do that. Industrial ecology looks at how much material and energy is going, you know, from a source in industry to the end consumer, as well as, you know, like what flows there are off of that, like what co-products there are, which is a kind of a more general term than waste, because co-products can not be waste. But, you know, basically looking at how much pollution is coming off of each stage in the production cycle, what types of pollution there are, like what material is going through there specifically, like what materials there are specifically, how much energy and all that stuff. And part of this is they look at, in their words, open paths versus cycles. So in other words, like if material and energy flow eventually comes back to producers from consumers, then it's considered a cycle. And that means that it's getting reused in some capacity. Mm. And so like in an ecosystem, everything gets reused.
Yeah.
Or it enters a stable form that, you know, doesn't cause problems like mineral ores or something like that. Mm-hmm. But the one of the defining characteristics of an ecosystem is that the wastes that parts of the ecosystem produce are used as nutrients and resources by other parts of the system.
Yeah.
And vice versa. So it focuses on trying to force industry to behave more like that. And then it also looks at short versus long cycles. So, like, a good example of this is plastic. Like, we've been discovering in the last few years that there are actually organisms that have been consuming plastic. And, you know, we know that plastic will eventually break down. The problem is it's going to take thousands, tens of thousands, or hundreds of thousands of years. And so that causes environmental impacts and, you know, that has to factor into the efficiency of our industrial system. Mm. And so that would be considered a long cycle. So we want to have shorter cycles where things are reprocessed as soon as possible and become, you know, available as materials sooner rather than later.
Yeah, yeah. I think,
and then finally, oh, go ahead.
On the concept of plastics, I remember thinking when that horrible M. Night Shyamalan movie came out, After Earth, with Will Smith and...
I didn't even see that one.
And his and his whiny child. When that came out, it was like this big thing about these guys are gonna return to the planet Earth where everything has evolved to kill humans, and I mean it's an interesting premise, you know, that we can be so harmful to a planet that it turns on us, but then they arrived on the planet and he was chased around by some baboons and that was pretty much it, and. I remember sitting throughout the movie the whole time thinking how idiotic it is that there's no plastic anywhere. It doesn't.
Oh yeah.
It doesn't make any sense. Plastic would not have disappeared that quickly. I don't care how fast an area can overgrow with vegetation. It doesn't work that way. A waste dump would not suddenly become a fertile, green, lush forest. And it was one of the standout kind of things of the movie, and it's something that I just thought of while you were talking.
Yeah, Wally has like the most accurate portrayal of
very
the
much
post-apocalyptic
so.
Future.
Yeah,
I think. Yeah,
which I think is why I love the movie so much.
Oh yeah,
like
for
I want to be positive, but I really do see people losing bone mass because they're stuck in floating wheelchairs.
So speaking of waste, the final part of the flow-based analysis that I highlighted was the use of analysis of waste as potential resources. So like I said, ecosystems use waste as nutrients or resources, and so they focus on how we can do the same thing you know, in our industry. So one of the big things highlighted in the book was that it really depends on the concentration of the waste, because a lot of our wastes are like aqueous, so they're like some small amount of substance dissolved in water, and so that can reduce the ability to economically extract any resources from it, because they have to process huge amounts of liquid in order to get a small amount of whatever they're looking for. Mm. And then the final strength is something that's near and dear to us, which is use versus sale, also known as products as services. So instead of going to a store in order to buy something that you need, you would instead go to a place to either borrow or just use a thing that you need. So if you need a really powerful computer for the day, then you could go to, you know, a computer lab and use a really powerful computer instead of having to buy it and then only use it for, you know, whatever thing that you're doing for a couple hours.
Yeah, and I mean, a great example of this is a tool library, which is something I highly advocate. Pretty much wherever I go, I think tool libraries are amazing. And they stem from the idea that the average person uses a drill for, I think the actual average works out to like 2 seconds a year or something, or 20 seconds a year. And it kind of highlights the fact that owning stuff is an archaic idea that we should do away with. And there's unfortunately a bastardized version of this Wizzy happening with intellectual properties like software, where
Are you talking about SaaS, software as a service?
Yeah, kind of. Where the closest people will come to this right now is if they pick up their ridiculously overpriced iPhone X. And when they realize that the apps that they have purchased to go on that operating system don't actually belong to them. They're literally what they have paid for those apps, in the cases of apps that they've paid for, is for use. They're basically renting the item, which is not the same as use versus sale. Because the way I understand tool libraries, you're not paying for it. You know, you don't pay for using a book in a library. You don't pay for, or at least you don't rent it.
Right.
We are paying, obviously, in the form, at the moment, we are paying for a library book in the form of taxes that go towards subsidizing that library. But, you know, that cost is so negligible because it's spread out across an entire population that we literally think of it as free.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's use versus sale for ecological purposes where, you know, we would encourage things to be shared in order to reduce the impact of producing those things, and so that we can, like, you know, increase their utilization. And there is use versus sale in terms of increasing your revenue because, you know, some things are expensive to distribute or maintain. Sometimes you can just charge people more by charging them to use something versus charging them to own something.
Yeah, it's like called rent.
Most of the infrastructure of the internet now is turning into the usership model. Mm-hmm. Like increasing numbers of sites are using Microsoft Azure or Amazon AWS, which are you know, they're hosted software services where they do everything for you, but instead of like buying it and then you get to use it as much as you want for, you know, years and years, you basically pay rents or a lease. Like in the case of Microsoft Azure, they sell like Azure credits. And so depending on how much you, how much of your server is used, it costs more or fewer Azure credits. And when you run out of Azure credits, you either have to buy more or your site goes down. Yeah.
Well, that sounds truly horrible.
Yeah. I mean, there are good aspects of it, like not having to maintain your own server infrastructure, having a consistent development environment, things like that. But yeah, the payment models always suck.
Yeah, like, pretty much.
Anyone who likes paying for stuff is a stupid asshole, and
if you're listening to the show right now,
you should change your mind or stop listening because we're not for you.
Yeah. Okay. So just while we're on the concept of material flows, I remember not last year, but the year before, I found some really interesting research. It was also to do with industrial ecology that I was doing at the time. I found a website called materialflows.net, which focuses very strongly on research into material flows. And it was where I first encountered a study of global material flows, where they look at extraction, they look at trade, they look at consumption, and they basically look at how all of this flows throughout the global industrial sectors, looking at an industrial ecology for the entire planet. And it was shocking. I'm not gonna lie, my mind was blown. The latest one I can find, I'm not sure if they're still collating data for everything since then, or if I'm just haven't done a proper search. But they did an analysis from 1980 to the year 2013. And what they found was that the highest numbers for per capita material extraction can be observed in the Oceania area. So that would be your South
Indonesia.
Southeast Asian regions, predominantly. Where at the moment,
that's also where most I think where most illegal mining takes place.
Yeah, because what they found was that in those areas, you're looking at approximately in 2013, it was approximately 61 tons per capita. And that would be an annual rate. And when you look at how populous those areas are, you're talking about a vast amount of materials being extracted. So this basically reflects a steep increase in production of fossil fuels, in particular, obviously, coal, as well as metal ores in Australia. And this is all just over the past 30 years. And we're talking about a growth of between 250 and 380%, depending obviously on the minerals that you're looking at specifically. So Oceania came in number one for extraction there. North America ranked second with per capita extraction of around 22 tons. This was in 2013. Which interestingly is down from 26 tons in 1980, but it's not the full picture yet. We'll get to that in a second. Now, due to the high amounts of industrial minerals, fossil fuels, and biomass extraction, you start to get this picture of a general increase globally, especially when you consider that between 5 and 11 tons. Developing nations in Africa and in Asia, they're characterized by the lowest per capita extraction numbers. But the per capita extraction in Asia has increased significantly after the turn of the millennium, where it was around 6 tons in 1980. It's now almost doubled to 11.5 tons in 2013. Obviously, that trend has still carried on. We're in 2017 now. You're probably looking at closer to the 13-14 range. So this area of extraction then obviously affects the global average, where per capita extraction increased from roughly 8.2 tons in 1980 to 11.8 tons in 2013. But now, just to be clear, this a lot of people would jump on this and go, oh yeah, you see Asia, China, oh my god, they're terrible. This is extraction. We're not even talking about consumption and trade yet.
I think it's really like they're the last frontier of colonial extraction of resources.
Yeah, there's, you know,
we've kind of
there's nowhere
stripped
else left.
South America and Africa dry.
Yeah.
Obviously, Europe was done a long time ago.
A very long time ago, and never had that much to begin with.
And then we're busy in the Middle East right now. And we have
finishing
been for a
long off the
time.
Last of it, to be honest.
Yeah. There was an article that I saw on that JSTOR news site that you linked me to, which is like that $1 trillion worth of minerals in Afghanistan that was talked about back in, like, 2010, useless now because of war, so.
Yeah, well done. Well done, people. Okay.
All right, so we're running a little long already, so we should move on.
Okay, I just very quickly want to talk about how we contrast this material extraction with a paper that was presented and what it did was it analyzed material flow-based indicators and provided an assessment of extraction, trade, and consumption of all countries across the globe for the time range 1980 to 2009. What it found was 94% of global resource extraction and consumption increase in the past 30 years to a level of around 70 billion tons a day. In absolute numbers, Asia plays the most important role, And in 2009, extracted, imported, exported, and consumed around half of all globally extracted materials. But per capita material consumption increased most rapidly in the fast-growing emerging economies such as China. At the same time, the share of OECD countries in global material consumption has significantly decreased, along with a shrinking contribution to the group of global GDP. So among the OECD countries, the per capita consumption remained more or less constant across the past 30 years, but material productivity has increased in the majority of countries, leading to a relative, decoupling. But the relative improvements were overcompensated for by what the capitalists obviously call economic growth. So along with the growing absolute levels of material consumption, environmental problems such as climate change or water scarcity has also increased ridiculously. So based on the data, it has to be concluded that the world as a whole is not on track towards greener growth or a greener economy or any of the buzzwords that fly around when people talk about sustainability in capitalist society.
Right.
Okay, so yeah, this is just to show what material flow analysis as done by industrial ecology. It doesn't just have to focus on a single industry. It can look at the full global ecology. Okay, so we've spoken about the strengths of industrial ecology, but what are the weaknesses? You know, I don't know of any field of study that doesn't have weaknesses, except of course for genetically modified organisms. Obviously those are completely flawless without any problems, and anyone who questions them is anti-science. This is not one of those. So what are the weaknesses of industrial ecology?
So the major one, even though I did say it's more radical than, you know, neoclassical economics, it's not that much more radical. It does contain a huge amount of neoclassical influence, particularly the idea that the prices of goods are basically correct. The only problem is they have these things called externalities, which, if you don't know, I guess most people aren't nerds like me that study economics without having to. if you don't know what an externality is, it's the idea that like pollution and harm to the ecosystem and harm to the social sphere, these all have real costs that could be figured into a price. The only problem is, companies don't have to pay for these things. So, like, if we just got the government to make the capitalists, you know, factor these into our prices, then prices would be accurate again. And then the economy would be rationally calculating how to best allocate resources. But that's a load of horseshit. If you go back and listen to our price episode, you'll hopefully understand why. But, you know, basically, costs are not like a reflection of some real physical value. Mm. They are power-based. And the reason that companies don't have to pay for pollution is because they have the power to not do that. Mm. And the only way that pollution could be quantified into a price is by the amount of power that would have to be exercised in order to repair the damage done by the pollution, which is not really it's not really an accurate cost, because, you know, in the case of causing global mass extinction at a faster rate than any time in Earth's history, there is no way to fix that.
Yeah.
You can't just, like, you know,
you can't
build a factory that makes new elephants and animal, like, other animals to fix the problem. Mm-hmm. So there's no cost that could ever be assigned to that would ever be accurate. But in this book, in almost every single article in the book, they talk about how we need to internalize the costs that manufacturers are not paying by making them pay for their pollution somehow.
Yeah, like, it's almost like they never heard of BP.
Yeah.
I mean, how much is marine ecological systems worth. Apparently, it's just a few billion dollars. But none of the fines that have been issued and paid would ever be able to reestablish those marine ecologies. What that's going to take is centuries, if not millennia, of leaving it the fuck alone.
Yeah, or actively working to restore it. I mean, there are ways that we can restore ecosystems, but like, there's no way that we could put a price on that.
Yeah,
and they're not going to be the same as they were before, and they may not work as well.
Mm.
So like, beyond the, you can't really replace what we destroy. You can't even predict how well the replacement's going to work.
Yeah,
and we have trouble even figuring out like what the contribution of an ecosystem is to human society to begin with.
Mm.
So
mm.
It's just an impossible thing to ever calculate, let alone to figure into this rational process of economic calculation that allocates resources perfectly efficiently.
Yeah.
So the next one, maybe it's just specific to this book, but some of the authors have pretty like America-centric and kind of racist views. One in particular, I don't even know why they included this guy. I guess it's because he's a National Academy of Engineering fellow or something like that. He's basically a lifelong shill for the fossil fuel industry. Like, he started two foundations to advocate for the use of natural gas, and his entire article was, well, actually, you know, using fossil fuels is good because, I mean, how can you even argue this? Like, obviously the increase in quality of life to all humans in the world because of fossil fuels is just undeniable. And he basically is erasing the history of horribly extractive industries that, as we mentioned earlier, colonized Africa and South America, enslaved people from those places, destroyed their way of life, and all in service of, you know, making the U.S. and Europe better places to live for those people. And so, like, you know, a lot of the views in history that I saw there were very much, you know, America is great because we have such good, smart people that create industry the right way. And so, like, we need to be a leader going forward because we've been such a leader, you know, all this time. Meanwhile, ignoring that, you know, our leadership has been on the backs of billions of people around the world
mm-hmm.
that get no such benefit. And then I guess the last one is kind of the same as the first one. It's just not nearly as radical in its analysis as social ecology. So even though it does look at industry as analogous to an ecosystem, it doesn't quite look at industry or human society as part of the ecosystem, as Murray Bookchin did. And I think one example that highlights this is the idea of the open cycles, or the open paths versus cycles. There aren't really any open paths, because anything that we produce as waste ends up in the ecosystem, you know, and it has to deal with it in some capacity. So they're not really thinking of humans as a subset of the ecosystem. They're thinking of human society and industry as something totally separate.
Okay. Yeah. I'd completely agree with that. I would say it basically as maker magic is not as good as neighbor science.
So we did have this, how can it be improved? And I guess I already kind of touched on most of it. I will say one of the points for how industrial ecology can be improved or integrated into left politics, international social anarchism. A lot of the book talks about how countries could improve. They do talk about doing things internationally a little bit, but I would say that was the minority of articles. Mm. You know, most of them were focusing on industry as a system, or setting, you know, national goals. Like some of them, one or two of them said that, you know, oh, like the U.S. or Europe has made a lot of progress, but they, you know, they don't really question whether that the environmental progress that has been made has been a result of exporting that to, you know, places like China and India.
Yeah.
But yeah, so they never really questioned capitalism as a whole. But capitalism will never be ecological. I actually think I have no way of like really proving this, but I think that capitalism simply cannot function without fossil fuels of some sort. And this might actually be just like empires in general, because capitalism is a very imperial system. But like the Roman Empire was fueled by destroying huge amounts of old growth forest and using that as fuel. Mm. Early capitalism was fueled by wood as well, and then coal, and obviously we're still fueled significantly by coal, but later, you know, oil. And I think
at the moment solar and wind and everything, while we talk about it being a very hopeful energy base for the future, the fact of the matter is we are still talking about vast mineral extraction that has to happen in order for it to function. And in that sense, right. In that sense, fossil fuels are still driving the energy that allows these commodities to be capitalized on, that allows the natural world to be turned into commodities. So... yeah, that I agree with you 100% there.
Yeah, and then like there's no evidence that capitalism can work without growing. Just the way that capitalization works, it requires, you know, companies to just be continuously increasing their revenue.
Yeah, you have to have an above average return on revenue. In fact, far as I know, it's kind of law. If you don't give your shareholders a return on investment, they're allowed to fire you and find someone who will find them a return on investment.
Yeah. And then so renewable energy, you know, any form of sustainable energy is inherently going to have some sort of limit to it.
Mm.
We're going to grow into the limit that we can reach, and then we're going to stop. And then our energy production is going to kind of level off. And once that happens, there's no way that capitalism can deal with that, because, you know, you can't have increasing levels of production in an organization without increasing levels of energy input. It's just impossible.
Yeah, entropy does not work that way, people.
Yeah, so I think we can say pretty confidently that there is no way that capitalism will ever achieve ecological sustainability, and it is the root of the problem of unsustainable civilization.
Yeah, as Murray Bookchin said, all ecological problems have their root in social problems. And I think until fields like industrial ecology start to see industry as one aspect of the overall ecology, they're going to miss the mark, unfortunately.
Yep. So I got some articles. I just pulled out some excerpts from them. That are related to this topic, that can maybe illustrate some parts of it. One thing I didn't mention is eco-labeling. They talk about that in one or two of the articles in the book. And so I found an article on, I think it was on that JSTOR site, called The Eco-Label Fable. And it focuses mostly on eco-labeling for fish, specifically for... the OceanWise label, which is a Canadian label for restaurants to use to show that the restaurants sourced their fish sustainably. So I'm just going to read the passage that I pulled out here. A study published in the journal Fisheries research shows that market forces can lead eco-labeling schemes to make questionable claims, potentially driving down standards. And people are catching on. Consumers don't want the equivalent of a green check mark, Atkinson says. We see terrible eco-labels out there that have absolutely no meaning or substance to them, and then we see more valid and trustworthy ones. Figuring out which one is which is hard for the consumer. And later on, a 2016 report by international conservation organization Oceana found that 20% of more than 25,000 samples of seafood tested worldwide was mislabeled. According to the report, up to 41% of seafood samples tested in Canada were mislabeled. The MSC, which is
a massive
U.S.-based, U.S.-based eco-label thing. The MSC does biannual DNA tests on seafood that carries its label and consistently finds that less than 1% is mislabeled.
Oh, there's nothing even remotely fishy about that.
Yeah, I don't really see how DNA could tell you where a fish comes from. That seems not correct. But the last part that I pulled out here is the MSC also requires restaurant partners to obtain chain of custody certification through an independent certifier who conducts annual audits. The restaurant must operate a traceability system and ensure there are no substitutions or mixing of certified and non-certified products. Which, that sounds pretty good, I guess.
It sounds good in theory, but then I'm reminded of Californian law, which basically states that all multinational corporations based in California are required to have transparent supply chains, and they have to report everything and anything and everything that goes into the production of their products. And last time I checked, which was about a year ago, but I doubt it's changed because it has been nearly 5 years of no changes. Last time I checked, the only mineral that had been declared by Apple in the production of the iPhone was tantalum. They didn't talk about the gold and platinum and diamonds that were coming from conflict areas. They weren't declaring the silica that was being reclaimed by child labor workers in hazardous, disgusting conditions in Southeast Asia and India. They, and I mean, really.
Yeah.
It's easy to say, oh, look how wonderful our traceability program is going to be, and then to not do anything because people don't follow up on anything past a headline.
Yeah. And then another major issue with this is that, I mean, it's an opt-in program, so it's not something that you're required to get. If this were a set of requirements, it would be significantly better, but this is just like an opt-in thing to make your product more attractive to consumers. And who is that going to be more attractive to? Who is it going to be marketed towards? It's going to be wealthy people, and we can't achieve sustainability without the poor. Mm. They consume resources too, and if they're consumption is unsustainable, but the rich are sustainable, who gives a shit?
Yeah,
like at best it's gonna be like, oh well, you know, I was eating sustainable fish, like why weren't you guys doing that? You know, you were eating the stuff from the supermarket that has no eco label certification to it, so you know my hands are clean. Meanwhile, the people that are doing this are the ones that are in charge of the companies that are causing this huge, massive problem of, you know, fishing the oceans into extinction.
Okay. Yeah, I completely agree. It's kind of disheartening, but this is the way things are. Eco-labels are part and parcel of capitalist society. And I think I mentioned
lipstick on a pig.
Yeah, I think I mentioned it in either our last episode last season or the one before that, where we were talking about Slavoj Žižek and his theory that capitalism is essentially incorporating charitable concepts into major brands so that we feel like we're doing some sort of positive impact when we buy into a specific product.
Yeah.
But the fact is, how many people actually check it out? So, yeah.
Right.
This is.
Do you want to read the next one?
Sure. It was this one you pulled out had to do with that the corals that eat plastic.
Yes.
And basically, what they found is that it isn't yet clear how much plastic is consumed by corals in the wild, or what harm it might do to these important marine organisms, which are already threatened by environmental dangers like warming seas and pollution. But understanding why plastic might appeal to them is important, especially because some particles appear to get stuck in the corals, potentially disrupting their digestive process. Hundreds of chemicals are mixed into plastics to achieve certain textures or other characteristics. Because the corals sense the presence of food with receptors, it would not be all that surprising if some chemical additives mimicked substances that set off the corals' appetites. This is something that was suggested by Alexander Seymour and Austin Allen, who were both graduate students at Duke University when they led the study that this excerpt is taken from. In their experiment, the researchers offered corals collected from North Carolina's coastal waters two different kinds of plastic to see what would be more popular. Plastic dipped in seawater and covered with a thin layer of bacteria, or weathered plastic without added bacteria. The corals seemed to prefer the bacteria-free plastic, ingesting more of it than the other shards. Now, the difference...
That seems like they're changing more than one variable at once, though. That's kind of weird.
Yeah.
Those are strange alternatives.
Yeah, look, I think there's limits to the effectiveness of this research. However, I do think it's important that this kind of research be done, because, let's face it, microplastics in the ocean, it's a huge problem.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, just to finish off, the difference between the consumption of the two plastics could come down to the concentrations of additive chemicals. So perhaps the microbes on the first set of plastics kept those added compounds from reaching the corals as swiftly. Or maybe the microbes produced substances that kept the corals from eating them as quickly. The research wasn't clear on that. Like I said, there were limitations to the research.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I thought that was interesting. You know, it kind of highlights the idea that there are no really open paths. Every waste that we produce eventually... that we produce eventually ends up in the ecosystem and is processed by it in some way.
Yeah,
and that doesn't necessarily mean it's processed in a way that's okay for the ecosystem.
Agreed. I think the big takeaway for me is that it's highly important that industrial designs start taking into account the fact that we need to switch to cradle production. Rather than cradle-to-grave production, you know, the open path versus cycles. And, yeah.
All right, so the next one, I got two articles from an industrial ecology journal, and the theme for the journal for that month was 3D printing. So we got two articles on 3D printing. I guess I'll read the first one. You can read the second one. We might have to... summarize it a little bit because it's kind of long.
Yeah. I'm not going to read that whole one, but I'll skim through it.
Yeah. So the first one is just called 3D Printing in Industrial Ecology, and it's talking about you know, the role of 3D printing in industry going forward. And so it says, additive manufacturing is not inherently zero waste as some had hoped. It is true that using subtractive manufacturing, which means traditional manufacturing techniques, techniques that begin with a block of material and remove some to produce the final shape, generates waste or scrap that additive manufacturing can often avoid. There are, however, the supports mentioned above, which what they're referring to is some 3D printing designs require some supports be produced in order to maintain rigidity while, like, before the item's complete. So the supports mentioned above and residual feedstock in the production process that are inherent elements of some types of additive manufacturing. But the biggest waste-related impacts may revolve around whether consumers end up with more goods and thus an increase in end-of-life waste and in the associated emissions and resource consumption upstream in the supply chain. There's growing consensus that the biggest environmental benefits will come from the production of parts that are lightweighted because of additive manufacturing's capability to produce objects with complex geometries. So it can improve our ecological situation, but not in the way that most people think, which is that it uses less waste material in the production process. Because I'm pretty sure that most of those processes that remove material, especially for metals, like, they recover a lot of that material.
Yeah.
It's not like remove it and then throw it in the garbage.
Yeah, it sort of reminds me of this smoker's joke where the high-end cigarette factory is the same factory where you will find them making the slightly lower end and then the lower end and then the really cheap cigarettes. And the way it works is that after they've made the first batch, they'll go around and sweep up everything that's fallen on the side, put it back in the machine and roll out the next batch. And by the time you get to the really cheap cigarettes, there's so little left that you just roll these hand rolls. Yeah, pretty much. So there is a reduction in quality with each repetition of collecting waste materials and repurposing them into similar or the same production techniques. But at the end of the day, there's a lot of overstatement about the wastage that goes into, what's the word now, man? Not additive, but subtractive.
Subtractive manufacturing.
Subtractive manufacturing. The industries have spent decades working on ways to reduce their wastage, because obviously for them, it makes a lot of economic sense to reuse stuff as much as possible. And at the same time, right. I'm not a huge fan of 3D printing. I find it the hype around it was ridiculous a few years ago. Like, oh my god, it's gonna change everything, as if it was a Star Trek.
I got into many arguments on the Futurology subreddit with people who thought that everything, like literally everything in the world, was gonna be made with 3D printers, and it's just like, dude, have you ever like even touched one or made one?
Yeah, I got to see one in action, and it made a doorknob, and it took 3 days, and the doorknob broke on the first day that it was used.
Yeah.
So I'm not even...
Yeah, it makes cheap plastic shit, which, like, you know,
don't
sometimes
get me wrong.
That's good, but it's not going to replace every product in the world.
Yeah, don't get me wrong.
Obviously.
When you're dealing with rapid prototyping, you don't get better. At the moment, if
but
you
rapid
need to,
prototyping is not manufacturing.
Yeah,
so
it's a part
that's
of the design process. And if you can rapidly prototype something for an investment pitch, and you then get that job and it's all good, then you will probably end up going with an injection mold at the end of the day, because that really is the fastest and cheapest way to produce en masse. So it's kind of ridiculous for people to hail 3D printing as the absolute game changer.
Yeah.
Okay, moving on very quickly to the article, the second article on additive manufacturing, which is...
This headline made me think of you, because it says knock-on in it. You're the first person I ever heard using that term.
Woohoo! So basically what it looks at is operations and supply chain management, and it asks whether or not there is sustainability benefits or virtuous knock-on opportunities presented by 3D printing. Just very quickly, based on additive final manufacturing, it is possible to identify four ways that operations and supply chain management can contribute to the goal of improving sustainability. Additive manufacturing-enabled supply chain practices address these problems by 1. Reducing transportation through localizing production. 2. Reducing material consumption through reduced overproduction and, in some cases, simplified production operations. 3. Extending the life of products in use with additive repairs and on-demand spare parts. And 4. Upgrading and refurbishing products in use with improved parts and components. Now, this is actually kind of self-explanatory if you understand the technology. Obviously, when you need that door handle, you don't need to go and start up a new factory that produces door handles and extracts vast minerals and then ramp up production into the billions of units in order to get the price down to where it's affordable to put a new handle on the door. A 3D printer, in this particular micro sense, it does. It has a sustainability benefit. Whether or not...
And these four things are all... They're all basically hypothetical. These aren't things that, like, someone... You know, a bunch of people were using 3D printers, and they're like, wow, look at all these benefits that we got from 3D printing. These are all things that someone thought down or sat down and thought, like, oh, what are the possible benefits of 3D printing?
Yeah.
So the article goes into more depth about whether or not these things are actually true.
Mm-hmm. Look, there are industries that I think are showing a lot of benefit from 3D printing, such as the medical industry. You know, mm-hmm. being able to rapidly print. I saw a documentary the other day about this kid that had a horrible accident that literally shattered both femurs. In his left and right legs, and I can't remember his name, but the accident it shattered everything. There was no way they were going to be able to operate, and the first option was to amputate. And the family was distraught, and they begged for an alternative. Wasn't there a way? Couldn't they put steel pins? And one of the junior doctors said, "Well, look, if you have full X-rays of his legs." We might be able to 3D print him metal legs, and I mean that it has been done, and we can do amazing things with it. And based on X-rays that, luckily, he had been in a similar situation. Similar, he had a car accident about 6 months prior to that. And he'd broken, not the femur, but one of the lower, the tibia or the fibia, I'm not sure which one it was. And because of that break, they had on record the full femur. And making a few adjustments for the growth in those 6 months, they managed to print him two new legs, and it worked, and they saved his ability to walk. So... I mean, there are these really cool applications of the technology. I've seen 3D printed ears. I've seen 3D prosthetics is a massive place where parents are able to print customized prosthetics for their children that have suffered amputations. There are massive benefits, but the whole concept of it changing industries, I'm not with that. They have limited application in very limited industries.
So while you were talking, I was looking on Google. I did find the kid's name. It's actually tragically ironic. His name is Walker Foot.
No!
Just kidding.
Oh, God, that would have been hilarious. You had me going. Well done. Okay.
Yeah, so do we want to, like, talk a little bit about this? We're pretty close to having the full time done, but we can talk about the points that the article makes about those four benefits.
Yeah, definitely. They did talk about how the first point, basically...
So, like, the big problem, with reducing transportation is that it assumes that, you know, you can produce the whole product right there with the 3D printer. And then it's done.
Yeah. And it's not always the case.
It doesn't really work.
It's not always the case. Yeah. I mean, again, a doorknob, sure, whatever. But the moment you start looking at more complex items, I know there are several companies that are desperately trying to find a way to develop a 3D printer that can do more than 20 materials. So that they're able to 3D print a phone in one go, a smartphone. But none of them are making much progress at the moment because the complexity that goes into producing a cell phone, we are talking about something that is insane. So insane that Apple is unable to be transparent about their supply chains. Nice concept, but not really that great. The article does talk about furniture, the way that IKEA does it, which brings up the fact that there's an IKEA that's about to open up here in Bahrain. They've been building it for the last 3 months.
Oh.
And I'm not going to lie, that the local population, including my wife, are very excited about IKEA opening here.
IKEA is pretty good, you know. I mean, they're bad, but they're good.
Yeah.
You know, it's nice to be able to get really cheap furniture if you're not rich. Interesting fact about IKEA, they use 1% of the world's wood.
Wow. That's a shitload of wood, man.
Yeah. It doesn't sound like a lot, but it is.
It really is.
Yeah. I think most of it, though, fortunately, is like in the form of like wood chips. So they probably aren't like using, you know, virgin wood. They probably are using quite a bit of like reprocessed wood. Yeah, which, yeah. Okay.
Which I suppose is not bad if you think about it. However, damn, that's still a lot of wood.
Yeah.
And that brings us to the next point, which is the reducing of material consumption through reduced overproduction. At the moment, when you look at the way things are produced, they're not produced according to actual demand. What happens is most factories, I'm going to use T-shirts because clothing can be 3D printed now. There are some systems that work on it.
I need to get me one of those.
I think it's lame, to be honest. I'd rather just go buy a blank T-shirt and have stuff printed on it. But in essence, at the moment, a factory will produce, let's say, 100,000 shirts in a week. And those shirts will then be packaged, and they will go into a warehouse where they will sit until such time as they are sold. And they won't be sold until the best possible price is found for them. And in the meantime, you will have hundreds of thousands of people walking around homeless with barely any clothing. So there's no kind of link between the demand for clothing and the actual production of clothing. And this is something that something like a 3D printer could theoretically address if they are provided relatively open access, relatively free, you know, marginal cost and all that. Theoretically,
now we can make sure only people with money ever get clothing, and we don't produce any more that could possibly end up on a homeless person. That's the advantage.
Exactly. we can produce individual socks that can be given to house elves, and all the dobbies can be free.
So the next one is for extending the life of products with repairs and spare parts.
Which is kind of obvious, to be honest.
Yeah, and yes, it does work in some cases. One of the big issues is you need to be able to have like the digital file for that part to produce it, which a lot of companies are they're just not going to release to you.
Yeah, that's not how their intellectual property works.
Right. And
fortunately, look, there are places like there are maker spaces and fab labs and that kind of stuff where people will work with you to try and create those digital files, but it's not always that simple.
Yeah. And then the other thing about it is
it's kind of related.
Extension of products isn't self-evidently positive. Like if you're, you know, replacing a part for your shitty old weed whacker, then, you know, that weed whacker could be like far less efficient than a new one, and you end up consuming more energy by continuing to use it for another 10 years than you would by just getting a new weed whacker.
Why are you still using 3 phones and an iPod Nano when you can use the new iPhone X?
Yeah.
The only other thing I was hoping to mention, but I think we're kind of running out of time today, is, you know what, I'll include these as links at a later stage. Maybe when we put up the podcast, I'll add in some links. I found in some industrial ecology journals that they did comparisons of hand washing and washing machines and laundromats in third world countries and their uses, and they found very obviously that hand washing uses the least water and energy, but that large quantities of detergents are used, while machine washing and laundry services use more or less the same amount of water, but laundry services use much higher energy because they also use dryers. What was interesting is that it's social changes that affect the use of one of the three technologies, because you're looking at stuff like increase in work for that's available for women, and the nature of how the housing setups work and so on and so forth, that affects it. So there's an entire study that was done on this fascinating subject that I will put up afterwards. And then the last one that I pulled up was about how renewable energy technologies are looked upon favorably to provide for future energy demands and reduce greenhouse gas emissions. But the installation of these technologies requires large quantities of finite material resources. And when we apply life cycle assessments to 100 years of electricity generation from three standalone renewable energy technologies, solar, river, hydro, and wind, just to evaluate environmental burden profiles against baseline electricity generation from fossil fuels, what we find is that it measures similar modest savings in technologies that are already pretty low in greenhouse gas emissions. But the eco-design specifically is what has the potential to provide significant savings rather than the technology concept itself. When we spoke about how efficient a technology is, it's not the efficiency so much as the overall design, which is how I think this ties into industrial ecology. As long as these new technologies are designed to run cradle to cradle rather than cradle to grave, it means that in 100 years, we're not going to be dealing with crumbling infrastructure. We're going to be dealing with something that is essentially renewable in the fullest sense of the word.
So I think that covers the topic pretty well.
Yeah. For those of you who still don't know what industrial ecology is, wake up! Obviously, you fell asleep.
Yeah, I will. The Journal of Industrial Ecology actually has like a surprising number of free articles, so I'll go ahead and link that in the description because there's a whole lot of stuff in there that you can read about if you're interested. We finally set up a Patreon. We already have our first supporter, Duke Brandon of Vancouver.
We thank you, Your Grace.
The title of Duke. Yeah. So once we get the deed to our lands, we will grant you your duchy, and then you can, set up your own vassalage system there. You know, you can grant a fiefdom to your counts and viscounts and barons. Yeah.
Just so you know, Your Grace, the land will be in North Korea. which I sincerely hope won't be a problem.
Yeah, no, just, and follow the teachings of Juche and then you'll be fine.
Exactly, exactly. Have yourself some kimchi and everything will be good.
Yeah, is it Kimjang? I don't even know. I think we missed it already.
Well.
So, yeah, the URL for that is patreon.com/neighborscience if you're interested in contributing. We're thinking about setting up some other rewards that aren't, feudal based. But we haven't figured that out yet. Part of the issue is going to be like whether or not we can actually ship things to people, based on their location. And I have no idea how much that shit costs. So go check that out. Give us a rating on iTunes if if you can, if you, like, especially if you don't have extra money to throw our way. You know, we do work full-time jobs, so this is going to be more like an investment into infrastructure of the site, paying for the website, getting Peter a mic that's actually good.
Yeah, I need a new microphone, people, please.
Yeah, so if you don't want to support us monetarily, that's fine. Just go on iTunes and give us a 5-star rating. Otherwise, you're a terrible human with no redeeming qualities at all, and we disown you forever. Yeah, that's it for us.
That is it for us, and remember that if you're not a utopianist, you're basically a schmuck.
All right, bye.
Cheers.